This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Retired General Michael Hayden has been part of the American intelligence community for decades. He served as the CIA director under President George W. Bush, and he ran the National Security Agency under the Bush and Clinton administrations. So, what could make a retired four-star general who has led two U.S. intelligence agencies nervous? Well, among other things, the current administration. In an op-ed in the New York Times, General Hayden writes, quote, "It is fair to say that the Trump campaign normalized lying to an unprecedented degree," unquote. His new book is called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. In just a moment, we'll get started with General Hayden, and we'll find out how life in what some would call a post-truth era is changing so much about America. We'll get to that after you hear this.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it. Support for NPR and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from award-winning vineyards around the world. Learn the stories behind each one and enjoy unique bottles inspired by your favorite NPR shows like Weekend Edition. All with the convenience of home delivery. A special welcome offer includes a bottle of Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon. If you're 21 years or older, join in the fun at nprwineclub.org/1A.
General Hayden, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
First of all, how did this book come about? What made you decide to write about truth and the intelligence community?
Yeah, I found myself thinking about it a lot. And some things came to mind. Let me just kind of give you a stream of consciousness of the things that popped up that said, you know, you ought to write this down. And so we've had a presidential campaign in 16 and now an administration in 17 and 18. And it occurred to me that the high friction points of the administration with the broader society were with the intelligence community, justice, law enforcement, science, scholarship, and journalism. And it occurred to me, what do all those things have in common? They're all based on evidence. They're all truth seekers. Now, they each have their flaws and they have their good days and their bad days, but their only safe haven, Joshua, is that they pursue the truth. So why is it that the high friction points of the new administration is with these institutions? And it struck me, the Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year for 2016 was post-truth, defined as decision-making based not on data or evidence, but on emotion, preference, feeling, tribe, loyalty, grievance. That flies in the face of Western civilization since the age of the Enlightenment in the 17th century. And that should worry everybody as part of Western civilization, but Joshua, it should really worry Americans. Because those guys who wrote all this down here in the late 18th century, they were Enlightenment scholars. The ideas of the Enlightenment imbue our foundational documents. And if we're walking away from the values of the Enlightenment, evidence-based reasoned decision-making, it's a threat to our very existence.
There has been a lot of talk in the last few years of what Stephen Colbert called truthiness on
right.
his show before he left Comedy Central.
Right.
And last year, the New York Times published this full-page list of what it called outright lies that the president told in his first roughly 5 months in office. It's since expanded the list online. Here is a clip of that list from the Times.
I think we have the all-time record in the history of Time magazine.
I guess it was the biggest electoral college win since Ronald Reagan.
Obamacare covers very few people.
North Korea has nukes. Japan has a problem with that. I mean, they have a big problem with it. Maybe they would, in fact, be better off if they defend themselves from North Korea. Maybe
with
we
nukes.
Would be better off, including with nukes, yes.
They said, I want Japan to nuke weapons. Give me a break.
But if you say to Japan, yes, it's fine, you get nuclear weapons, South Korea, you as well, and Saudi Arabia says we want them too.
Can I be honest with you? It's going to happen anyway. So it's only a question of time.
part of the list from the New York Times. General Hayden, how did we get to this point? How did this happen?
So this is important, Joshua, because my book talks a lot about the president, but I go out of my way to say it's not just about the president. All right. So I imagine this little three-layer cake in front of us. All right. The first layer, and by far the biggest, isn't the president or the administration. It's us. In our, as a culture, going into this post-truth world that I described for you, not evidence, but feeling, emotion, tribe, grievance, loyalty. Now, Donald Trump, the candidate, recognized that and masterfully exploited it during the campaign. And I think as president, he worsens it by some of the things he says, but a lot of the things he says, and you just played a bunch. That's the second layer. The third layer is we got the Russians coming in over the top, recognizing the first and second layer, and using that to actually further divide their main adversary, the American people.
And how much, I know we have to pause in a moment, but how much of this do you put on the Russians as opposed to on us? Are they a big player, or are they just kind of a little bit player that found a gold mine?
Yeah, so Kentucky windage here, no real true calibration, 80-20.
80-20, 80% on us and 20% on the Russians.
Yeah, because, and by the way, the 20% is really effective because of the 80.
You are from Pittsburgh.
I am.
A Steelers season ticket holder.
Oh my, yes.
Yes, indeed. And you...
By the way, Jesse James caught that football against the Patriots. He really did.
And you tell a story about how you got together with a number, several dozen, I believe it was, Trump supporters. I presume to try to suss out their line of thinking in terms of their support for a candidate who deals so openly in mendacity. What did you learn from them?
So, first of all, my initiative, because everybody I talk to sounds like me, and I realize a lot of Americans don't in terms of this issue. And so I asked my brother, hey, get your friends. I'll pay for the Iron City. I'll pay for the pizza. We'll have a conversation. It was great. It was 2.5 hours. I knew a lot of people in the room. I'd grown up with some of them. I kind of walked up and said, so what are you people thinking? And they told me. And so what I found out is, number one, these are the soul of the earth. I mean, they go to work. The kids go to school. They go to church. They go to the PTA. They volunteer. They pay their taxes. They observe the law. All right. And they feel as if America has forgotten them. I spend a lot of time in the book talking about globalization. And I freely admit, because of the career I have chosen, the winds of globalization have been at my back. They have advantaged me and people like me. And for many of those folks that I talked to in Pittsburgh, that wasn't true. The winds of globalization were in their face, and no one seemed to care. And so they attached themselves to the candidate who seemed to be speaking to them. And when I brought up, but he says so many things that aren't true, it didn't matter as much to them as it did to me. It was more or less that it needed to do was rhyme with something they felt deeply about. And again, I mean, no judgment here, Joshua, but what they felt deeply about didn't have to be data-based either. It had to do with grievance and emotion and preference and feeling. So I walked up to them and said, okay, come on. How many of you really think Barack Obama wiretapped Trump Tower? And they kind of went, yeah. I go, you got to be kidding. You made this reference earlier. I used to run NSA. I know something about this. That wouldn't happen. What data do you have to believe it's true? And one person in the room kind of looked at me, shrugged shoulders and said, Obama.
Like, duh.
And that was it. That was the evidentiary stack sufficient for some number of folks in the room. Back to my post-truth as opposed to data-based.
I wonder, though, if we're talking at cross-purposes. I mean, I think about, you know, that movie Network, which is one of my favorite movies. Faye Dunaway's character, Diana Christensen, describing Howard Beale saying he's articulating the popular rage. And the only thing that makes him the hit newscaster is just the way that he presents it and that he kind of rants and raves and tells people to stick their heads out windows. But I wonder if part of the issue is not even so much the evidence, the facts, but dealing with this anger, which for a lot of Americans is perfectly legitimate in terms of feeling left behind.
That's why I go and talk to folks, and I really do try to treat them with the respect they deserve in the book. So what we had in 2016, Joshua, is we had two primal screams running for president, one in each party. One. I make the case that I get it, but primal screams are not effective methods of governance. And now we've got to move on and actually go do things, right? And I think we're most successful when the doing is based upon truth as best we can make it appear to ourselves. I get the pursuit of truth is hard and people can disagree, but to make decisions separate from data is inevitably destructive. Short story, but an important one. One of the early acts of the administration was the so-called not a Muslim ban, which looked everyone like, oh, what you got? Here's a Muslim ban. That was based, Joshua, on campaign rhetoric that refugees represented an apocalyptic threat to the United States, and the American method of vetting refugees was absolutely dystopian, and therefore desperate times require desperate measures, right? None of that is true. None of that is based on reality. Do you realize that five former directors and acting directors of CIA, two deputy directors, a director of national intelligence, and a director of the National Counterterrorism Center went on record in amicus briefs to the court saying that is not a real threat. And not only was it not based on data, which really disturbed us methodologically, it fell unequally on the world's least fortunate people. And oh yeah, one more thing. Doing that makes us seem to be the enemy Al-Qaeda wants the Muslim world to think we are. In fact, it was much as useless and unfair, it was actually dangerous. And that's what I mean by policies based upon emotion and grievance. One more example, back to the wiretapping Trump Tower.
Right.
Okay. John Dickerson from CBS, and I tell this story in the book because it so impressed me. He's interviewing the president on one of the Sunday morning shows, and the president's getting frustrated because John's kind of stalking him. And he's stalking him about Trump Tower. And he says, evidence, Mr. President, what evidence do you have? And the president finally, Joshua, out of frustration, says, a lot of people agree with me. A lot of people are saying, that is the essence of a post-truth world. If I can make it popular, if I can make it trending, I can treat it as if it were fact.
Bruce tweeted this suggestion. Bruce writes, people believe what they want to believe. Find out why they want to believe it. Why do you think, and you know, let's to be clear, let's set aside people who legitimately believe that Donald Trump has specific policy plans that would advantage their life. Let's set that aside. Yeah. That's mainstream politicking. But the people who believe truthiness, why do you think that appeals?
Well, look, I try to explore this in the book. It's kind of beyond my lens as an intelligence guy. My lens is intelligence, but I do try to dabble in it, all right? And so I actually got out of my comfort zone in writing this. I talked to people I never would have talked to normally, read things I never would have read, philosophers, historians, and so on. And Joshua, without kind of pulling us all back to our American history classes, a couple of folks told me, you know, this is like the 1890s. Bear with me, I'll be very efficient. In the 1890s, we had great disorder in the country. In retrospect, what it was trying to adjust the institutions of government that were suitable for governing an agrarian America and adapt them to what had become a very industrial America. Maybe we're doing that again. Maybe we now have the institutions that were suitable for governing industrial America, and now we're getting all mixed up trying to recreate them to govern post-industrial informational America.
It's interesting you mention that because a large part of what made America industrial, of where a lot of the industrial roots of America were laid, was during the Civil War.
Right.
And that was both an ideological and a technological war, and one ideology won and one ideology lost. Right. So I can see how it'd be easy for those cultural lines to also become economic lines that divide people even deeper.
But you bring up a great point. If you go back to Appomattox and the Civil War, you mentioned the Civil War. One of the battles that's going on right now, and again, you come back to your broad question. So how's this working? Why are people thinking this way? It may be about a great debate as to who we are. And again, I'm getting beyond. By the way, I can connect most of this in the book to actual intelligence processes, all right? But at its heart, there is a debate about who we are, and we see it, right? We are, by definition, we have been throughout our history what I call a creedal nation. What makes an American? Read the document, understand the document, swear to the document, you're in.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
Exactly, exactly. And we are moving in the direction where some Americans seem to be defining Americanness by blood, soil, and shared history. We thought that was settled at Appomattox. It's not.
I get the sense that for you as a career military man, as a four-star general, as an intelligence officer at the top of the intelligence apparatus, you also view this through a national security lens with regards to what's happened in other countries where information can be used. Yeah, where information, where this post-truth mentality can be used to do harm, to wage wars, to take people's lives. I wonder if there is one particular example of what you've seen in your intelligence work that you think, you know, hyperbole notwithstanding, that you think is a good cautionary tale for America.
So anywhere where you see demagoguery leading in the direction of autocracy. I begin the book walking through wartime Sarajevo and seeing this really beautiful, vibrant city now destroyed. And thinking, let me tell you what's weird. These Sarajevans don't look much different from us. I was shocked that they didn't look different. In other words, the veneer of civilization is really, really quite thin, and we need to keep that in mind. The shield against autocracy is truth. If there are no truths, if there are no agreed truths, there's nowhere, Joshua, to plant your foot and push back against the autocrat. Near the end of the book, I make the observation, it's not mine, I quote an historian up in New England, I make the quote, post-truth is pre-fascism.
So then what do you do? As a CIA agent, as a CIA director, as an NSA director, how do you push back? I mean, have we done this in other countries in ways that could be instructive to us?
So what I tell the folks doing inside the intelligence community is do your duty. Stand for the truth. Right, the very last line of the book, before I had to go write an epilogue because things keep happening.
Right.
All right. But the very last line in the book is after a visit to CIA, where I meet with old friends for a retirement ceremony, and I feel good about the people in the agency. And then I add, they know we've always relied on their truth-telling to save us from our foreign enemies. I hope they now understand we need their truth-telling to save us from ourselves.
B wrote on our website, the1a.org, if we do not collectively impose a cost for lying, regardless of partisan divides, we will be seeding our own destruction as a democracy. There is no way to be in on the lie. When our leaders lie to one of us, they're lying to all of us. Do we have to ride them out of town? No. But we cannot let it pass without demanding they acknowledge and take responsibility for their deception. It's so interesting. I feel like, I know we're winding down, but there's a sense of agency that I feel maybe for some folks who feel disenfranchised is missing. I read that comment from Gatto earlier. Gatto replied to me the fact that I read it and wrote, thanks. Sometimes this feels like the only way I, a nobody American, can speak truth to power. That feeling of powerlessness is real. A lot of President Trump supporters have said that they feel empowered through his administration. Right. I think I can't really... I can't be mad at them for that. Like, there's some, it feels like there's something to that.
So Joshua, back to the comment, 80-20, remember? It's 80% us. Let me give you something I didn't put in the book, but I should have, all right? For my professional career, those people in that room in Pittsburgh, they have been unrelenting in their support for me. I knew they always had my back. I can't tell you the last time I had a buy in Iron City in Pittsburgh, people were just, oh, Mikey's back. All right. So I love those folks. And I always thought throughout my career that I was representing them and their values to the national enterprise. Coming out of the back room in Pittsburgh, I began to think that at least for some of those folks in the room, they were beginning to think I was now representing the national enterprise back to them. And that troubled me.
Retired General Michael Hayden, former director of the CIA and the NSA, his new book is called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies. General Hayden, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.